G'day, g'day. I am alcoholic. My name is Bob. First thing I want to say is happy birthday, America. Now I want to give a little praise to Eva S., a staff member at our General Service Office and a dear, sweet lady. I want her to know how grateful I am for this opportunity to share during this magnificent celebration of recovery in our wonderful program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's all the adjectives I have. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. Eva is the one who issues the loving invitation to participate. Now, for those of you who read the program and came here expecting to see Bobo the Clown, I do apologize. I am not Bobo. And if you wish to leave, I won't take it personally. I come to you from Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan. And yes, that is a real place where we are privileged to enjoy the beauty of southern Saskatchewan and the inspiration of the program. Some of us have often heard that laughter is the best medicine, so I'll try to start you off with at least a giggle. My last initial, capital O, apostrophe, capital R, tells some of you of my Irish heritage, and this short joke relates to it. So this Irishman walks out of a bar. No, really, that could happen. See, I find that funny now, but before this program, I would have taken that personally and found it very offensive. Actually, all the jokes about the Irish drinking too much are misplaced. The real problem with the Irish is that when we drink, we all think we can sing. Growing up, I seldom heard and did not appreciate laughter. I was raised in a home wrecked by untreated alcoholism, so if anyone was laughing, it was usually at somebody. As a young person with no self-esteem, I hated to hear people laugh, because if I didn't hear the entire conversation, I feared that they were laughing at me. My adolescent years were very unsettling. You could say that in some respects, I was paranoid around most people. Remember, I grew up in the 50s, and where I came from, most of the jokes were at someone's expense, and probably now it's not much different, but in the culture of the small town I lived in, jokes at that time were very racist. In our house ruled by shame and blame, if I laughed at someone's expense, I then felt guilt and remorse. Although in the end both my parents were alcoholic, I inherited my mother's prematurely gray hair and my father's stature. I did not inherit alcoholism. With much practice, I developed my own illness. As time progressed and I discovered the soothing effects of booze, I gained some confidence, but it was dependent upon me having a few drinks before I felt equal to you. Of course, progressively, I needed more booze and less reason to drink, and the booze took over, and then I was not just equal to you. I was much better, faster, stronger, smarter. Most of the character in my face was put there by someone's fist because I never knew how to mind my own business and keep my opinions to myself. As you can probably figure out, I was not much of a fighter. Before I found my way to Alcoholics Anonymous, it didn't matter what the situation was, I thought that booze was the answer. Problem was, I couldn't remember the question. So shortly after I dragged myself to Alcoholics Anonymous as the last desperate hope of being able to stop drinking and stay stopped, a man with an enormous amount of sobriety, over 20 years, appointed himself as my sponsor and answered the myriad of questions I had about recovery. We were both in the Air Force at the time and shared the same technical trade, so we could relate to each other on more than one level. He helped me a lot, We talked regularly, and he listened to me whine and complain about the people I worked with, the neighbors, the clerks in the store, etc., etc. After each of these whining sessions, he would say, "Everyone on God's green earth has the absolute right to be wrong." It took me almost 6 months to figure out that he was talking about me, not them. Quite often I didn't know what he meant. He would say, "You have to mend your fences and plow a straight furrow." I knew nothing about farming, but he was talking about following the 12 steps. For quite some time, I was dead serious about combating this deadly disease of ours. I heard people at meetings laugh about their stuff while I was still trying to hide my stuff. I did not see anything funny about alcoholism and could not loosen up and begin to actually recover. I didn't drink and concentrated on just that. Life was still very serious and there was no recovery in my life. Even now, my spontaneity is planned. That is one of the lingering effects of alcoholism that makes recovery slower for some of us. With patience and tolerance beyond belief, this early sponsor eventually got through to me that life was worth living and that I needed to start enjoying the good things in my life. He finally taught me Rule 62. Don't take yourself so damn seriously. Once I began to lighten up on myself, I began to see the lighter side of life. Everything wasn't doom and gloom, and I could even enjoy a laugh with the people around me. It took time, but eventually I was able to laugh at myself. Suddenly there was many hilarious situations in my life. Situations that earlier were embarrassing now could be shared with those around me, and we could all get a chuckle out of my human reaction to normal situations. A few years into this program, I had the opportunity to attend an AA meeting in Bermuda. We met in what seemed to me to be an open-air chapel. And during the meeting, directly behind the chairperson, a lizard of some sort ran across the wall. Well, I just about had a big one, and as I rose from my seat to alert everyone to this dangerous situation, the man seated beside me calmly put a huge hand on my shoulder to keep me from panicking and said, "Everything is okay." After the meeting ended, we all had a good laugh about my response to a situation which was run-of-the-mill for the locals, but scared the wits out of me. In a previous time, this would have been very embarrassing to me and not funny at all. I can now not only laugh at my own mistakes, but I don't feel less than when something I do or say seems funny to others. With over 20 years of sobriety, I created a hilarious situation for folks who knew me. A good friend in a city about 150 miles from home knew that I would be traveling through on the weekend, so he asked if I could stay over and speak at his home group on the Sunday night. He explained that it was their monthly open meeting, and there would be an Al-Anon person sharing for about 15 minutes, and then I could do the same. I heartily agreed because the day I would be speaking at this group was actually my sobriety date. Now, he did say it was the group's open meeting, but my mind heard birthday meeting. I thought, how nice is this? I will speak at someone's birthday meeting on my own actual birthday. Well, the day came and I had supper with this friend and his wife. As soon as we finished the meal, he said he had to go early to the group because the person chairing had never chaired a meeting at this group before. He left, and not too much later, his wife and I headed to the meeting. Sitting talking before the meeting, I casually asked the chairperson whose birthday it was, and he didn't answer. He just looked at me with this deer-in-the-headlights look and then said he didn't know. Later, when we were joined by my friend's wife, and I noticed that there were people on the other side of the room signing what I presumed was a birthday card, I again asked the chairperson whose birthday it was. He said he didn't know and looked at my friend's wife with a look of horror on his face. I said, "I'm going to go sign the card," and my friend's wife said I didn't need to sign it. Again, I asked, "Well, whose birthday is it?" And the chairperson went white in the face. My friend's wife said, "Bob, it's yours." And I said, "Oh, you shouldn't have." That to me was just hysterical, all because I assumed that this open meeting was a birthday meeting. When my friend introduced me, he related that this was the anniversary of my actual sobriety date, and he presented me with a chocolate muffin with a candle in it. That was the real reason he left the house ahead of us. He said they were out of the banana nut flavor that he thought would suit me. Afterwards, we agreed that despite my misconceptions of what I was asked to participate in, the evening was a success. Once I learned through the program to relax and go with the flow, I was able to get off my high horse and not be afraid to make mistakes. This allowed me to be able to take service commitments in Alcoholics Anonymous and know that no matter what I did, some would not be happy with my performance. Others could point out the humor in it, in some of the things I did or said. I've had many opportunities to laugh with others while doing service in AA. "We are not a glum lot" is a very true statement. I know when I was elected as our area secretary, our newly elected delegate, knowing that I was deaf in one ear and went to the Hunt and Peck School of Typing, had one thought: what have we done? I had a good chuckle when he later told me what his first thought was. Eventually, I was privileged to serve my area as their panel 61 delegate. Prior to my second conference, I received the loving invitation to speak, along with four others, after the dinner for conference participants and their guests on the first day of the conference. We were limited to 10 minutes. People in New York are a lot smarter than some. I tried to be brief, to relay some wisdom, and hopefully say something meaningful. I wrote out what I thought was a pertinent and well-thought-out presentation, overcame my fear of being judged by my peers, and proceeded to do my best impersonation of a sober, competent, mature alcoholic. Well, after the meeting, everyone congratulated us on a job well done, but during the days that followed, I heard from some who were there that what they remembered of what I had to say were two of the terms I used. I said I came from a small town so far back in the bush that we had to come out to hunt. And the other was a term to describe my drinking. I said I would get floor-licking drunk. So that's what I'm remembered for at the epitome of my service to Alcoholics Anonymous. Who couldn't laugh about that? I guess I have healed a great deal in this program, not just because I can laugh at myself, but because I can enjoy life and the humor I find in it. My sense of humor is possibly quite different from yours. I know it is quite different from my wife's. Because at times we'll be watching something on TV and I'll be laughing out loud and she doesn't see what's so funny. For example, this guy is watching TV and his wife comes in the room and she says, "What's on TV?" His answer, I think, is hilarious, but my wife doesn't feel the same way. His answer to "What's on TV?" is "Dust." Of course, seeing the humor in a situation differs with all sorts of people. During my time in the Air Force, I had the opportunity to travel some, and I tried to get to meetings wherever I happened to be. On my first trip to Campbelltown, Scotland, I ended up going to the Alcoholism Society of Scotland to try and find a meeting. As I waited to see someone, a very well-dressed, smart-looking lady came into the room and asked if she could help me. I told her I was looking for the Friends of Bill W. I should have said I was looking for an AA meeting, but I figured the terminology would reveal if she knew about our program. To my total surprise, she pressed a finger to her lips, paced back and forth a few times, and then asked, "Did he send you here?" I had to explain how in Canada we often use that term to describe Alcoholics Anonymous, and she wasn't sure if there was a local meeting, but said she'd find out and let me know. Not really a humorous situation, but when I returned to my hotel about an hour later, the desk clerk spotted me going through the lobby and called out, in a loud voice, "Hey, Bob, that lady phoned and said she found an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Here, I wrote it down for you." Some people just don't realize the second A stands for anonymous. I was able to chuckle myself about that situation. At one point a few years back, I was having problems with dizziness, and the Air Force sent me to ear specialists of all sorts for tests. After one CT scan, or MRI, I don't know which, the ear specialist told me that there was less blood flow on one side of my brain than the other, but nothing to worry about. When the flight surgeon on the base received the results, he called me in to discuss them. I told him that the ear doctor said it was nothing to worry about, and he told me in no uncertain terms that that was the opinion of that doctor and not a neurosurgeon. He proceeded to ask me all sorts of questions about my condition, and then as he literally squirmed in his chair, he finally asked, "Was there ever a time when you drank to excess?" Bear in mind that this man is a senior officer and I'm a lowly airman, but I couldn't help myself. I burst out laughing. Well, the look on his face was total shock, and as quickly as I could recover, I explained that I'm an alcoholic and in recovery. He said that my excessive drinking may have contributed to my condition, but he couldn't say for sure. One thing I can say for sure is that I found that conversation much more hilarious than he did. I often recall that encounter with a smile and a chuckle. I'd like to close now with a joke. Of course, it involves some Irishman. I can't guarantee I didn't get it from the grapevine. Seems there are some people in a neighborhood bar in New York City, and they're having a few drinks. As the night wore on, one lad at the bar says to another, "I take it from the accent I hear from you that you come from the sod." The other responds, "Yes, I do. And what about yourself?" The first one replies, "I'm from Dublin myself, and how about you?" "Well," says the other, "I'm from there too. What street did you live on?" The first one says, "I lived on Hanover Street." "No," says the other, "don't tell me. I lived there too. What school did you go to?" "I went to St. Mary's Academy," says the first one. The other lad says, "The good Lord must be looking down and smiling. I also went to school there. And here we are, thousands of miles from home, and we're in the same bar talking to each other." First one says, "Now that's unbelievable. What year did you graduate?" "I left school in 1965, says the other one. "How about you?" Me too, he says. "This is truly a miracle." Just then a lady walks in and takes a seat at the bar. The innkeeper goes over to her and says, "G'day, Colleen, what'll you have?" She orders a beer and asks the bartender how things are going. He says, "Oh, it's going to be a long night." "Why is that, says the girl?" The barkeep says, "It's the Murphy twins, they're drunk again." With that, I'll close, and in front of you, I thank God, and in front of God, I thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Remind me, the first meeting that I went to in Southern California, they call anniversaries birthdays, and they have a cake with the candles, and people sing, and I didn't know any of that. But I went to my first meeting, and the secretary said, "We have a birthday tonight for Ruth for 18 years. And I thought, it's cool, they celebrate people's birthdays. I'm looking around, for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny hiney, you know. Ruth gets up, she's the only one walking to the front of the room, and the woman is 50 if she's a day. And first thing I thought was, God damn, if she's 18, she should stop drinking. But, then, you know, I'm a figure outer, so I got it. Okay, this is AA. They don't drink here. Ruth hadn't had a drink in 18 years. Happy birthday. Oh, my God, I cued the choir. I didn't know. You know, everybody started, 200 people start singing happy birthday. I'm a musician, by the way. I play guitar, and so when I hear, I can tell good singing, bad singing. I know the difference. And this was bad singing. This was 200 people singing at top of their lungs, happy birthday in four different keys at the same time. Many of them were not even committed to the key they started in. And I thought, they had a piano on stage. They had a piano on stage with a sheet over it. And I thought, somebody in this room can fake happy birthday on the piano. I know that can happen. In fact, I could even do it. I'm not even a piano player, but maybe I'll run up there and you know, yank the sheet off and I get them all in the same key. And then I thought, you know, that hero thing doesn't always work out like I think it's going to. So why don't you just shut up? It's a short song. So they're like, happy birthday to you. Then Ruth gets up. My name's Ruth. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Ruth! And everything. Jeez. My friend Scott used to say, this is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. I didn't know you could go to a meeting every single day, let alone for 18 years. But there was a guy standing up next to me and he said, hey, you don't drink for a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. If I don't drink for a year, I get a cake. I don't know how you feel about that. Seem like to me, if you don't drink for a year, you ought to get a car, you know. But by the time I got a year, I was happy to get the cake. I want to introduce our next presenter, Ray from Michigan.
My name is Ray. I'm a God bless drunk. I'm grateful to be here. What a great day to speak on the 4th of July. To be free from addiction. Is a wonderful thing. The size of this room can be intimidating, and the energy could be misinterpreted on the stage by me into nervousness, into a pass or fail type grade. But my buddy Mike always says in our home group, he says, AA is the only place where everybody in the room is pulling you to succeed. Because if I succeed, we succeed. You know, the energy in this room is what I did not understand when I got here. You know, when they talk about wanting what you had, that's the energy in this room. That's the energy of love that's in this room, the stream of consciousness of spirit, that we all are free from the addiction of alcoholism. You know, I usually don't do this. I usually don't read out of a book. But I'm going to do this for 1 second, and bear with me. And this is me. I worked the four-step my second time through the program, and I'm also going to go out of chronological order for 1 second, because it hit me last night. Just so powerful. But I was going to work this program and work this program until I felt what you people said, and I wasn't going to move off a step until I believe I completed that step completely. And felt what I needed to do, and was making a house that was standing on a rock bed foundation. But anyway, I missed this in the fourth step, and I read the fourth step about 100 times. I did the seven deadly sins, you know, the pride, lust, anger, greed, gluttony, envy, sloth, over and over, and all the different examples. But I didn't feel it. I didn't feel that release. I did a fifth step. I didn't feel the release. Went back to the fourth step, read it over and over again. And one day it jumped out on me. And it says, but it's from our twisted relations with family and friends and society at large, that about covers it all, that many of us have suffered the most. We have been especially stupid and stubborn about them. I took offense to that. The primary fact that we fail to recognize is our total inability to form a true partnership with another human being. One. When I owned that, when it hit me at the gut level, I was married and had three kids. And I could say that that was a true statement for me. I felt so disconnected from that family. I believe in the 50s they used to call alcoholism the lonely disease. And I know we all know that feeling. The reason I read that now is because I fast forward or backtrack to last night. The flag ceremony, the opening ceremony of this convention. 56,000 people. 94 flags. And I don't know about you, but I'm watching that Native American guy. And somehow he was me, and I'm just sitting there and said, "Don't quit, brother, don't quit." And he just kept going, and he just kept going, because he felt it. He was feeling it. And if you don't feel sobriety in this room, keep coming. Keep coming. This is a wonderful experience to be up here and look out at this. And if I could, I swear, I'd walk off the stage right now and have everybody come up one at a time and just say thank you for my sobriety. Because I get me sick, we get me better. I qualify for this program. I had my first drink on April 18th, 1970. I had my last drink on July 25th, 1988. I know the date of my first drink because my father, in his infinite wisdom, made me the bartender at my brother's wedding. I grew up in an alcoholic family. My dad was one of us, unrecovered. My mom couldn't drink, so she turned to IV drug use. And so he made me a bartender. I lasted 5 hours. And I did what I always did after that. I blacked out. I was a blackout drinker from jump. I blacked out the first time I drank. I blacked out the last time I drank. In our book, it says we're seldom mildly intoxicated, always more or less insanely drunk. And that's what I was. When I first came into this program, that same description of our total inability to form a true partnership was there. I thought the goal of this program was to quit drinking. I really did. And so I did that. But nudge, grudge, or judge, they say at home. You know, whatever it takes. You know, we all get here through the courts. A quart of whiskey, a quart of wine, a quart of beer. And I did that. I achieved that. But I stayed sober for 2.5 years on a grudge. I was going to show my wife, I won't drink. I won't drink for anything. And I didn't. But I became what they call at home a Sam. I was sober and miserable. And I was destined to drink again. Because I thought I was staying sober in the first 3 steps, first 2 steps, first step, no step, I went out. I lasted 6 hours. I lasted 6 hours before I got arrested. I was the most peaceful arrestee he ever had. I came out of a blackout and the lights are flashing because that's what we do. What does the alcoholic do when he's too drunk to walk? He drives something. And that's what I do. You know, and that's it. That's the healing through laughter right there. We can all identify and laugh with that. And at the same side, on the other side of that cereal box, is I have got the only disease that kills other people because I get behind the wheel of a car. But I'm not today. And so I can take a look back on that, and with identifying laughter, go, yeah, yeah. You know, Bob mentioned it, you know, the differences in the sense of humor, that the sense of humor I grew up, what was called humor, was who's the target today? Someone's always the butt of the joke. It was always passive-aggressive something. It was always that, you know, if it's not your turn in the barrel, I'd laugh, you know, as hard as can be, because it wasn't me. Yeah, look at my brother, you know. And that's not what it's like. You know, that's not what humor is today. It's a binding ingredient. You know, it's one of our common bonds, the ability to heal through laughter. But I got arrested. And what a prideful drunk I was. The first 2.5 years, I had lousy sobriety. I wasn't even sober. I was dry. But I didn't have to get my sheet signed. So I was better then. I wasn't identifying with anybody in that room. Well, sure enough, I get arrested. I got a drunk driving ticket after 2.5 years sobriety. And I have to get the sheet signed. And it was I was embarrassed at first. I'd wait until almost everybody was gone. I'd get the last guy. I'd go, you know, could you please sign this? I never asked for a phone number after the first 2.5 years. I never had a phone number. Never showed up early. Never stayed late. Never pushed in a chair. Never made coffee. Never chaired a meeting. Brother, I was on the run. And it caught up with me. But anyway, now I got to get my sheet signed. And lo and behold, without even asking, they start writing down phone numbers. And I get 18 months of probation. I got all these sheets. I got all these phone numbers. And I'll be darned if sitting at meetings, that didn't come in handy. Because what do you know? I got to have a pen and a paper. And on the other side of the paper, I start writing down something that you said and something that you said, something that hit me, something that I could use. And it set me free. You know, I came back, like I said, I came back to this program after getting arrested, being on probation, and I knew I had to get back. And the first thing I was going to do was get a sponsor. No matter what, I'm getting a sponsor. And I'm not a joiner, you know. This program asked me to do everything that's opposite of what I was really good at. You know, isolating, drinking, drugging. Become a joiner. Join in. Grab a hand. Say a prayer. And so I go to the first meeting back. I go back to my home group. I own it. You know, I went out. And I picked the oldest guy in the room to be my sponsor. Didn't know him. Have never spoke to him before. And he's got to have about 1 billion years of sobriety. Look at him. But anyway, I owe that man a debt of gratitude. And it's one of the reasons I'm up here today. Is to give back to Huey. He was a great first stepper. He's the only guy I ever knew who bat 1,000. If he said he was going to do it, he did it. Be there. He was there. Show up, suit up. He always used to say that. We suit up, we show up, and sometimes we get called to go in a game. And when they call you, you go in. Because you give back. Because that's what we do. We stay sober and we help another alcoholic. And that guy taught me so much. But I couldn't stand him at first. I absolutely couldn't stand him. He had this whole group of old guys that they get together 2 hours before the meet and go have coffee, go to the meet and have coffee, go after the meet and have coffee and ice cream. It's like, what? I'm 34 years old, and on Friday nights I'm sitting with these six old guys that are about 1 million years old all together and going, what am I doing here? But I was there, you know, because I knew the other side. I didn't know that leap of faith. I didn't know what was on in sobriety, but they had something I wanted. I knew that. I couldn't put my finger on it, but they had what I wanted, you know. And what it was wisdom. What it was peace. What it was a way out. Them guys, he used to say, you know, and I hated that guy at first. I would call him up, and I'd say, blah, 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 blah. I'm going through this. I got a lot of fear going on. He goes, and he wouldn't even listen. He'd just rattle off a page number, and he'd say, read this, call me back after. And he'd hang up the phone. But I'm ripping him up and all that. And he would do that over and over again. And I thought, man, this guy knows the big... He must have wrote that thing. You know what I mean? He knows this thing inside and out, backwards and forwards. Well, now fast forward a couple, 6, 8 months. My wife knew him before I did. And for side money, she used to clean houses. Huey lived with his mom to take care of her, or she took care of him. I don't know. But anyway, here was Huey's chair where he operated, because he sponsored 12 to 13 guys all the time. He's a great guy, great friend of AA. I tell you, he was a good, good man. But anyway, here's his chair with his pad of paper and his, you know, ashtray. Smoked like a chimney. And I'll be darned if he didn't have a guidebook for AA, and it listed every page for any kind of emotion or whatever. And he'd just sit there, and he's watching a ball game, and he'd pick up the phone and go, ah, hell, read page 69, and he'd hang up. And it's like, oh, man. I thought he was the smartest guy in the world, you know. it cracks me up. I come to understand by going to coffee and go and get an ice cream after Friday night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, that what I thought the goal of this program was quitting drinking is incorrect. The goal of this program is to live sober. And the quality... the quality of my life hangs in remembering that. Because if I forget that, and things just... that it's about substance abuse. That's why only the first step mentions alcohol. You know? The other steps are the entryway into a wonderful, wonderful life. And I need to remember that. That's for sure. I came in here, and everything happens in divine order. I truly believe that. I struggle with every aspect of this program. I dug my heels in. You know, I dug my fingernails against the inventory, definitely against spirituality, a God, and my understanding. It sounds like hocus pocus. You know, it's not going to work. My God. The most loosely organized organization works perfectly. You know? And it's like, how can that be? How can that be? My brother used to say, you know, he asked me all the time. I characterized my brothers as hard drinkers who quit drinking. My oldest brother passed young. But, you know, because he goes, well, if I watch too much TV, I could be a TV-aholic, you know. And I was like, dude, you don't get it. You just don't get it. I've got the factor. I've got that X factor. We're just wired a little different. You know, and all this stuff comes together at the right time. Because I'm hanging. I'm putting myself in a position for this stuff to be heard. I'm putting myself in a position to succeed just by hanging with these guys who had been there, who are passing on what they've got from you. You know, and they said, the one guy who we used to call him the godfather of sobriety, he was the most peaceful guy. You know, he had 30 years of sobriety when I met him, and people would just go up to him and almost in reverence, and he would just dispense this knowledge. Go on your way, you know. But anyway, I was in the middle of a table one time. I'm sitting there talking, blah, 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 and he stopped me. He goes, Ray, if I was you, I'd buy a dictionary because you have no idea what words mean. And I was like, so I did that. I did that. I'm on a shoestring budget, so I go to the Salvation Army. I bought a dictionary for $1.25, and he said, the first thing you should do is look up the word sober and pick out one of the definitions. And one of the definitions is of sane mind. And so I latched onto that one. That's my goal. I just want to be of sane mind. And I carried that with me for a long time. That led into reading other books, you know, and I started picking up other materials. This Came to Believe opened up a lot of books because I needed to find a higher power. I knew that. But anyway, along the line, I thought it'd be a great idea also, I should read some of the classics. So it was either by Steinbeck, Hemingway, or somebody like that. I can't even remember the book. I don't know the book title or the author, but this is what I do remember. Somewhere in that book, they were talking about two buddies met after being separated for a long time. One had become a millionaire and then went broke. And the other guy couldn't believe it. He goes, how in the world did you go broke? He said, well, two ways. He goes, slowly at first, and then all of a sudden. And that's the same way I got sick. That's the same way I ended up in AA. A couple of problems here, you know, lost a girlfriend there, got arrested over there, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, life isn't worth living anymore. All of a sudden, that morning came after being arrested after 2.5 years of sobriety when I was never suicidal in the sense of actually physically doing it, mental fantasy, most of the time. And I just sat on this couch and I just wanted to be poofed and gone. Just take me, God. If you have any mercy whatsoever, just poof me off this planet because I did it again. And I couldn't stand that thought. But you know, I'm open-minded because I'm going with these guys. And I don't even have the money. Seriously, at this time, I had $33 after child support and because that was the last straw with the wife. And I got child support for three kids. And I got $33 a month to live on. And I'm living with a guy in AA, and the room is slanted. The floor is tilted. We got mice coming everywhere. But I'm going to meetings. I'm going to meetings. I got so much pride. I lost my license. I'm riding to meetings on a bike. I'm carrying an umbrella when it rains because I wouldn't ask you for a ride. And it's like, but I'm hearing what I'm supposed to hear. Because some guy was talking, and he's describing alcoholism or alcoholics and the way we're wired and the way we think. And he was sitting there one day, and he goes, you know, I wouldn't take a drink for $1 million today, but I might take one for free tomorrow. And that's me. You know, I'm so, I can identify with that kind of thinking. This time has flown by. It really has. I'm extremely grateful to be asked to be here. It's humbling in a great sense to be a part of this. I've been blessed enough that I was in San Antonio. And just to see that, we had our 14-year-old My beautiful wife was sitting over there. And he was with us. And what we do... I'll close with this. We're walking home last night from the opening ceremony. 56,000 people. The force we have, you know, clean and sober, to bring it to our families, then our grandchildren. And it just goes on and on. Each one teach one. You know, we heal the planet one person at a time. One alcoholic to another alcoholic. Thank you very much for supporting me.
Thank you so much, Ray. Both Bob and Ray talked about sponsorship, and if you're new and you don't have a sponsor, it's a really important to have a guide through this jungle. You know, you read things in the book, not to take anything away from the big book. I love it. We all love it, but you can misinterpret. There's a phrase in chapter 5 that suggests not only honesty, but rigorous honesty. Rigorous honesty, and you can misconstrue that. If you're new, like if you go home and your wife says, "Honey, does this dress make me look fat?" That's not the time for rigorous honesty. You know, there's a correct answer to that. Rigorous honesty would be like, "No, baby, I think it's the Haagen-Dazs." You know, you know, the dress looked fine on the hanger. I mean, let's go try it on that skinny blonde next door. See if it makes her look fat. It's a dress then. But now, see, you guys get it. That's what I'm talking about. Follow your sponsor. I lie to waiters all the time. Waiters, you go in a nice restaurant, a waiter says, "Sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner?" He's not trying to ruin my life. He's doing his job, you know, but I just lie to him. I say, "No, thank you." Because there's a part of me that just wants to go, "Boy, I would. I like a cocktail instead of dinner. I like it more than my next damn breath, you know, really. I like a double Bushmills neat and a margarita back. And just keep them coming. No, but don't do it. I'm playing with you, man, because listen, I have a disease. I have an illness, man. It's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy and spiritual bankruptcy. I don't think you want that in your nice restaurant, do you, son? So you have to be careful between rigorous honesty and rigorous stupidity. Boy, I'm having so much fun, and I'm excited to introduce our next presenter, Karen from Alberta, Canada.
I'm Karen. I'm alcoholic. And I am from Alberta, Canada. And happy birthday. You guys can sing your national anthem in tune in Canada. We don't sing our... We sing it like happy birthday all over the place. Can everybody hear me okay? Okay. Here we go. So when I got the invite to come and speak here, my husband and I too, I Googled this and I saw and I went, because I just, you know, "Karen, would you like to be of service?" I said, "Yes." And then I ended up here. And when I Googled it, my husband comes into the room and he says, "Wow, Karen, that's just a few shy of 10,000. You probably want to get a new dress." So. Pardon? I'm a member of the ABC group, which meets Wednesday nights at 8 o'clock at the Presbyterian Church off Varsity and Shaganapi in Calgary, Alberta. I got sober May the 22nd, 1990. And my son gave me my card at my 25th birthday, and he's just coming up 4 years sober. And I had to go to Al-Anon to have a bit of a sense of humor as he went through this disease. Yeah. So, humor and healing. So, you know, I'm dying of the disease of alcoholism, and I come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and the thing that got me was your laughter, and that's what's kept me here. You know, my first meeting, and I was really sick. I weighed 93 pounds. I was dying of alcoholism for quite a while. I drank to be comfortably numb, and if that still worked, I'd still be there. But it doesn't work. It's a progressive illness. And I found out I had a disease. I wasn't just nuts. We got nuts in our family, so I was really happy to be alcoholic and not nuts. And I went to this meeting, and you know, I got sober in this teeny little town. And really, I didn't like people, so I was very happy in this little teeny tiny place in the woods, in the Kootenays. And we all know what the Kootenays is good for, at least you do in Canada. And anyway, so I'm living there in away from people. I didn't see people for 5 days, and I liked it like that. And at the end, that's how it got to be. And I loathed myself. I remember looking in the mirror, and I tried to quit drinking for so long, and I couldn't quit, and I couldn't quit. And I'd be drinking, and I look in the mirror, and I think, why don't you just die? That's how much I loathed myself at the end. I used some bad words, but I won't hear. And and today, it's just completely different. But I ended up in this hospital, and some AA people, I was like, there's a live one at the Crescent Valley Hospital. And so all these AAs are coming there, and they're helping me understand the disease of alcoholism, and that I didn't have to keep living like that, or dying like that, more to be the point. And they talked to me about this higher power. And I thought, I don't like God, like the rest of you guys. I heard that here too. Well, Karen, why don't you come up with your own concept of God? And you know, a little bit later when I was reading in the big book, I saw that same line, and I thought that they wrote that book for me. And so I went to this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and these guys in this little teeny town were talking about, well, Karen, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. And then they'd say, you know, when I first got sober, I remember I come to one morning and the cows are licking my face in Frank's pasture. And Frank is in the meeting too, and then everybody had burst out laughing. And I remember when so-and-so threw his chainsaw through the front window of the RCMP car, and everybody had burst out laughing. And I thought, I want to be able to laugh. I'd done so many shameful things, in my opinion. And I was ashamed of myself. And but you guys were laughing, and I wanted that. And so that's why I've stayed here. And I tell you, I've really found a way to laugh. I chased away two husbands because I tried to control drinking too. And I got crinkle lines in the middle of my forehead that is still proof to that, that I can be a real restless, irritable, and discontented person when I'm not trying to find a higher power. So the journey through this has led me to a God that loves me for who I am. And in that journey, I found out how to love you for who you are. And I've learned to be able to laugh at myself through laughing with you as you discover yourselves. This is the most beautiful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous, is being able to to find our connectedness, because really we are all one. I believe that, and even sitting last night in that huge auditorium, and I too am absolutely astounded at how powerful we are with love. We have so much power in laughter and love. And you know, when we're walking around the city, and there's a few crabby people, because there always are, even in us. And as we're walking around all these, but most of us are saying please and thank you and have a nice day. This is such a beautiful energy that we have here. And we, you know, we've been dragged off the scrap heap of death to shine from within, our light from within. I'm so grateful to be a part of that. Yeah. So one time I'd been through a particularly difficult time in sobriety. I had, you know, gotten to a relationship in early sobriety, and I thought that God had given me somebody, and actually did. That man brought me to my knees. He helped me face my biggest issues, which is I like to make you responsible for who I am, and then I like to blame you when things don't go right. That works really good for a no, it doesn't. It's a very painful way to live. But this man gave me this gift. And I went to some counseling to find out how to have relationships. And then I worked the steps, totally using the steps for healing. And I found out that fact about myself. So at the end of this couple of years, I took a couple of years just to get to know Karen. And I was sitting by this river. And I was thinking, it's the Bow River, it's a beautiful river. And I was thinking, you just got to go with the flow. Karen, just go with the flow. And I was just totally relaxed in that. And then this spider gets between me and my sunglasses. And I fling my glasses off and I'm trying to get this spider off of me. And I've got these really baggy pants on, so I don't want to kill it because then it's going to rain. It's finally nice. And I just like get this spider off of me, and I pick up my sunglasses. Now they're broken. I stick them on my face, and I look around to see if anybody had done that. You know, it's sort of like when you're doing the polka in the olden days, and you'd fall down and jump up, and nobody saw that. It's sort of the same thing. And I stand up, and I was just like, this is life. This is life in God's world. You just sort of just figure out how to go with the flow, and then some spider comes between you and your sunglasses. It's been like that for me my whole journey, I tell you. Anyway. But, you know, in that moment, as I find my humanness, and now as I sponsor women, and I'm blessed, I sponsor a lot of women, and I get to help them find, through humor frequently, at least I start with humor. Might end up with a 2x4, but I start out with humor. And to help them find their truth, because that's really what's worked for me. You know, as the whole journey here has been, you've been laughing at yourself about something, and I hear that, and I take that home with me. My first sponsor said, Karen, when I was doing amends stuff, she said, go and ask your mom what her memories of you are. And so I went, I was walking through the pasture with my mom, and I said, Mom, what do you remember most about me as a little girl? And she said, Karen, you were the most selfish, self-centered child I ever met. And as long as you were happy, everybody was happy. But if you weren't happy, watch out. And I come to find out here, like, I'm surrounded by selfish, self-centered people. I'll bet your mom say the same thing. And this is our freedom. This is the freedom that we come to recognize that within ourselves. And we get to be free of that. And we get to be free of that through loving God. A God that's forgiving and kind and generous. I almost missed that as well. Okay, so I'll tell you a little bit about when my son Michael got sober. Because that's a real miracle. Because I got a little bit crazy when that kid was drinking. And then he got into the drugs. And he threw away our beautiful grandchildren. And his ex took them away from even Jim and I. And it was a very difficult time. It was a very painful time. And I wanted to smack that kid with a 2x4. And he needed to have his journey just like me, just like my parents watched me become 83 pounds or 93 pounds and dying of alcoholism. And then, so one day I was working and I kind of felt this, we only saw him once a year. We'd drive through is where he was living and we would stop in and see him and he'd tell us all about how the world's going to fall apart and you got to come out to the Kootenays. Just like I used to do exactly the same stuff, only now they have the computer so you could even have more facts. Anyway, and so we drove out to see him and I didn't get to drive out to see him this one summer. And September came along, and I thought, I can't do a winter without seeing him. So I drove out. I just had this urge to go out. And as it's a 6.5-hour drive, and I stop in Radium Hot Springs to get a cup of coffee on the journey. And I run into two people from my Al-Anon club that I was going to. I was like, man, all right. Yes, Karen, all you can tell him is that you love him. So I drove out. And as I'm driving, I don't even know where he's living anymore. And I drive out to the Kootenays and I see his stepmom and I pull over and Marion, I say, where's Mike? And she goes, oh, Kevin. She's German. Oh, Kevin's very bad news. So she goes, oh my God, that's outside. Like, you go here and you go there and there's a white truck and a big tree and there you find him. And I went there and he isn't there, but I heard his laughter. And in his little coffee table in this rundown place that he's living is the big book. So I kind of knew the timing was right. And when I got there, I heard his laughter and I walked down the street and he's sitting in his car with a beer bottle between his legs and he's skinny. And he looks up and he sees me and his face changes. And he said, oh my God, Mom, you wouldn't believe what I've been praying for. And I was able to say to him, what are you going to do about it? And I didn't ask for I didn't give him direction. I let him make his choices, and he's still sober today. And it was absolutely beautiful moment to have your child. And I know that's hopeful because, you know, some of our kids don't make it here. Yeah. Just like some of us, we haven't made it here, and some of our kids don't make it here. So it's a gift. But when I brought him back to Calgary, and I emailed my friend Joe, and I said, Joe, what should I do? Here's Mike. And he says, well, get him to detox, and then get the F out of the way. And I got out of the way, and I let you guys have him. And we got another grandkid now, and those other grandchildren that were taken out of our life are slowly making their way back. So that's a beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. I don't really have a whole lot else to say that I... But I've learned here not to take myself so seriously. I've learned here to lighten up. In the old days, people frequently told me that I think too much. And I don't think too much anymore. I just try and be in the present and live in the moment and give what I found freely. And I hope you all enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.